753 DVNA, or Advantage R3267 spectrum analyzer, or Advantage R3754B DNA. So, talking about the equipment, I still have a 4194A impedance gain phase analyzer that is 45 years old. It measures CGLR, and you can see the crosstalk and dielectric constant, if you wish, of PC boards as well. So it depends from the what you prefer, what is good for you, but definitely for $190, it's a good stuff to be to have. Dr. Ray.
Yeah, I think I see it on Amazon. As far as I'm aware, it's not a vector network analyzer. It's purely a spectrum analyzer. So I'm not quite sure. I think you mentioned that it includes VNA, which it doesn't seem to.
No, I only said that if you have a two-unit separate. I'm not very much for having combo units, something that... if you remember 60s, a boy was going to the beach with the radio that had a tape recorder and whatever players and TV sets in it, and then one thing broke and you didn't have all of it. And nothing was at great quality, so at best is if you have a separate unit. So CC Tiny SA Ultra is just a pure spectrum analyzer, but because it comes with a bunch of wires and the card and the how do you call it? SM connectors and two wires connecting to it. Is for $200 is worth the price. But
okay, I mean, and Amazon has it $199 and has a $25 coupon on it. And fortunately, it seems to be in stock someplace in the United States because they give a shipping delivery for the 27th, which means it's not coming over from a slow boat from China. Yeah, I have the Tiny SA original. I would probably have to kind of take a good long look. Yeah, I got the one with the 4 inches because bigger displays are better for me in these days. It probably has far less spectrum. I think it only goes from up to 800 megahertz instead of 5 gigahertz. So, it sort of depends. Having one kind of toy spectrum analyzer is one thing. Having two might be excessive under some circumstances. So I appreciate you reminding people that the Tiny SA still is around and getting better. That's the nature of electronics, fortunately.
Yeah, I found the description of it. So it says 150 watts attenuator, 2 cables, 1 USB cable, 1 SMA to SMA barrel connector, an antenna, telescopic antenna, and micro SD card, touch screen pen, and SMA to SMA, 2 wires, probably about 7 inches long. All of it comes in one pack for $199.
Okay. Like I said, the first time I saw it a couple of years ago, I bought it, and I promoted it. It's not going to take the place of a $10,000 professional piece of equipment, but it's inexpensive and can be very useful for many amateur radio operators.
Oh, definitely, especially when you just use your telescopic antenna connect with SMA connector on it, connected to the unit, and it's portable. You can hear all of the signals all around. So this is good stuff. Now, the next topic is something for you, as I'm not a professional in this area. I have not much knowledge in it. So we're talking about motor, but now we have a biological motor. We have a motor that was created by nature, and that was from the video of Smother Every Day, and it's about bacteria flagella. In 30-minute video of Smother Every Day on YouTube, which shows a microscopic organism poses as incredible rotating electric motor. So if you could say a few words about it, Dr. Wright.
Okay, obviously this is not really medicine. This is molecular biology and such. When I was going to college back in the 70s, there was a guy who was promoting a brand new shiny idea called nanomachines, atom-level machines that did things. Unfortunately, life kind of beat him to it by billions of years, because each of our cells does millions of things simultaneously that would give us migraines. Just think, if you ever have nothing better to do, look up a couple of pages of biochemistry to see how sugars are made, or how sugars are broken up, or any little relatively simple cycle in the cell that goes on 24/7 or such. And so part of that is flagella. Flagella are transport devices. They are rotators attached to helical whips that when they turn one way or the other, they direct cells in one direction or the other. You might be very familiar when you were very, very, very young and half of you was a sperm, because that sperm had a flagella. And if it didn't, it wouldn't have gotten to become you. So the idea of molecular motors that we call flagella, how it evolved into being. Unfortunately, I didn't particularly care. I usually like the guy who does these YouTube. He's an engineer. I think he kind of did one of those. Well, it could be intelligent creation. You never kind of know. Look it up yourself and make your own decision. Well, I can't make my own decision about relativity. Relativity is a thing. I don't have to agree with Albert. It's still a thing. So I think that evolution is still a thing. But it was an interesting YouTube, and it's an interesting concept of how do complex structures evolve. The idea is that if any part of it hasn't evolved yet, it's completely worthless. And that's really not how evolution works. Evolution kind of repurposes a lot of things over time.
Thank you very much for that. The guy is right now PhD. He graduated his PhD long time ago. He is from a quite well-established family in space and avionics. If I'm not mistaken, he's an electrical engineer, but right now the PhD. As far as the groundbreaking research, it was conducted by Everson Lab at Vanderbilt University. We're talking about that video from Smart Every Day, which talks about the organism that possesses a rotating electric motor properties. We could use it, name it this way. Ladies up.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
His grandfather was an electrical engineer.
Okay, thank you very much for correcting it. So, the Dr. Everson has made significant strides in understanding the intricate mechanism of bacteria flagella. I do not pronounce it properly, using advanced imaging techniques that they have captured unprecedented views of those nanoscale motors in action. Okay, anyhow, we have not much time, so I'm going to go quickly to the next one. I would like to have the attention of and help from Paul, a space engine. There is some kind of puzzle, because from one hand, we say that this steam engine was used 2,000 years ago, and over 2,000 years ago, and then if we go just to the history of modern rocket, we see those rockets using steam engines as well. If we start from the Second World War, we have flying bombs on the steam engines. We have a Japanese kamikaze airplanes on steam engines. We have V2, the German first rocket that was bombing Great Britain, and it was a steam engines, and then plenty of them. We have the X-15 American, we have Yuri Gagarin that goes to the orbit on steam engines, and many of others. But I know that right now the United States doesn't use steam engines any longer. So Paul, maybe you could put some light on it.
Okay. And the website that you sent, that was the YouTube, was one of them was 1.5 hours long, which was actually interesting. The average person, I don't think we could get through it. You know, I've read a lot about the Russian engines, so yeah, I found it very interesting. So if you like Russian engines, you know, that was a good, very good YouTube. And as far as using steam, they have peroxide, not 3% peroxide, but you know, 50% or even 80% peroxide, and then that gets mixed with the catalyst and instantly turns to steam, and steam. But it's not pushing the rocket into space. It's spinning the turbos, the turbo pumps, and the turbo pumps are spinning the oxidizer. In most cases, it's liquid oxygen, and the fuel nowadays is RP1 or really kerosene. They use different fuels you know, through the Russian program. But what the Russians used was this peroxide that was spinning up the turbines, and to think that the steam is pushing it to space, that it's not. It's steam is pushing the turbines are turning the pumps are pushing the fuel and the oxidizer into the chambers, And that's what's exploding and getting you into space. Back to you, Wes.
Yeah, the Russian Soyuz rockets still use steam engines till today, so they use, right, that's what you said, the hydrogen peroxide H2O2 over potassium permanganate KMNO4 and catalyst to create high pressure steam, which then spin the turbine to power the pump. And the origin of the first Soviet rocket engine steam was World War II. Actually, it was interesting because the whole train with the engineers and designers was arrested by Americans and brought to the United States. So whatever the Russian got was something what they were able to steal. Nothing that Yes, but it just happened that most of the technology they use wasn't their own, wasn't invented by them, but it's still there. Let me drop. And interesting fact is that I'm sorry. Trying to drink the coffee. not this way. Okay, so 90% of technology they have right now is not made in Russia, and about half a year ago President Putin decided to give okay for Russian companies to use without a patent American technology and any other technology, so I don't call it any other way, but unfair position of intellectual property. But anyhow, my question was, when United States decided to not use steam engines any longer, if you know, Paul?
Yeah, well, the A4 engine was invented by the Germans, and that was part of the B2 rocket. Actually, also the B1 rocket, the ones that used for they were like little airplanes that had an engine attached to it. But the big ones, the B2, the ones that bombed England. The pumps were driven by a peroxide, which turns to steam, and so now the end of the war comes along, and Russia wound up taking German scientists over to them, so they tried to duplicate the process that the Germans were doing, and the Americans, of course, we got a hold of von Braun and maybe 800 other scientists and forced them over to the United States, and we wound up using those guys to help with our program. We took some of the A4 engines and the B2 rockets from Germany, and so did Russia, and they were built on that, but we decided that as time went on, not to use that same steam to drive the turbines. We went with afterburners, before the fuel got, you know, it got into the main chambers. It would go to these pre-burners. They were like small rocket engines. They would ignite with the fuel and the liquid oxygen, and the exhaust from that would be used to drive the turbines instead of steam. So the turbines again turn, and they turn the pumps, and that's how the Americans decided to go with that system. It was more practical. To do that, a little bit more technical to develop, but you know, that's what we all use today. Private companies, NASA uses it on their RS-25 engines for the shuttle, and then eventually now for the same rockets that we're going to be sending to the moon, the Space Launch System, the SLS. They use the same engines. Anyway, we switched over. It really gets involved with, you know, if you want to go down to the countless different engines, let me drop it. That was developed, you know, some of the exhaust, you know, on the early ones, even today, you know, go out into space. It goes through the turbines, and then the exhaust goes right out into space. They've developed the ones that the exhaust now goes into the chamber itself, so this way you're not losing anything. They say it's more efficient, and SpaceX has developed that type of engine with the Raptor engine. So, you know, Russians also developed that. That type of system too, with a closed loop system on a couple of the larger engines. But you know, that goes into engine development. You're talking about the steam end of it. Anyway, I saw that other video that you had with the steam it was an organ that was being pulled along on a parade and the thing went on fire. That was interesting. A lot of good topics. Like I wrote back to you guys, you could spend an hour and a half on this topic alone. You don't want to do that. Back to you, Wes. W.S.
Absolutely understood. Absolutely. Yeah. So look, I usually when I watch the video, I watch it speech too. So it's very fast. They talk very fast, but I just don't want to spend too much time on trying to get knowledge. What I've memorized is that V2, the German rockets, they were bombing Great Britain during World War II, were using liquid oxygen, 75% alcohol. Now, the next one, which is related to steam engine, I wanted to make a puzzle, but actually Dr. Voy answered to that puzzle within 30 seconds, so maybe he would be able to explain it better. So there was this a video that was called Steam Organ Explosion, and that was Jasper Marble Steam Engine Days 2024. There was a steam calliope, which is like a steam organ incident in Jasper Marble Steam Engine Days in Marble, Minnesota. That was on September 7 and 8 in 2024. So initially it was described as Oregon steam explosion, but thankfully it was just a fire. And so that reminds that steam calliopes must really be handled carefully, although they are kind of old devices that they're very much retired and are in the museum right now. However, it's a tradition, it's American tradition. So I had a few questions about how could steam catch a fire, and why those fire extinguishers didn't work. Maybe Dr. Voigt could explain, and maybe somebody from the audience would be able to answer. Dr. Voigt.
Okay, AC2GS. Well, obviously, you know, steam is gaseous water. Water does not exist that much in high concentrations in normal pressures and normal temperatures. So you either have to lower the pressure a lot or you got to increase the temperature, which is what these things do. It's the source of the steam that exploded. There's an energy source that's burning, that heats the water, that boils it into steam, that lets the steam do the calliope's thing. But the propane gas or whatever fuel can the valve regulator can fail or the tank can leak. And so you basically have a natural gas explosion. And it takes time to get a handle on it. You know, you can spray a lot of fire extinguishers. There's a place called Turkmenistan, which I think is the third largest supplier of natural gas. They did some excavations, the Russians did, back in the 70s, and a crater just collapsed in on itself of a big trapped amount of natural gas. And some brilliant Russian there decided to set it on fire so that the natural gas didn't kill everyone. And that fire has still been going on. It's about 60 years old. So it's just a natural gas explosion. That's why it explodes.
Okay, and the last one, thank you very much, Dr. Roy, is the last subject that I have is your car designed to fail at a certain point? Is it planned obsolescence? Are you talking about the timing belt that can end your car life? Let me drop. It was a public concern in 2024, financial as well as environmental burden of the thousands of prematurely failed engines. One of the videos that I sent to Dr. Rui was who approved this and why is still being made. Wet belt, which is a tiny belt now, that is inside of the engine enclosure, not outside of it. All the guys could remember that it wasn't belt that was used, but it was a chain that was used. The calculation says that the driver saves about $15.83 per year because of the rubber timing belts versus the chain, but at the same time you have to change the oil every 10,000 miles or less. And in 2007, Ford introduced the engine where the wear belt was exposed to engine oil all the time, and it was not only exposed, it was actually submerged partially in the oil. So in 2008, Renault, Opel, Vauxhall, Volkswagen, Peugeot, and plenty of other companies decided that they're gonna go with the belt instead of the chain because it was thought that it's gonna hold 2,100 kilometers, which is 150,000 miles. So you have a break of the belt, you actually are ending your engine life because the cylinders losing the synchronization will hit the top of the cylinder and you don't have engine no longer. Let's drop. So in other words, it's a timing synchronization between camshaft and crankshaft, which means that the piston will hit and bend the valve or interference engines, which requires engine to be rebuilt. If it is still to be rebuilt, if your block is not damaged, and timing belts, even though that they are made right now with hydrogen, hydrogenated nitrate, butanite rubber, that is heat resistance and oil. We're talking about the small engines in our cars, especially in Korean one, Japanese. I'm not sure, but I believe Japanese never went for those belts. But European, yes, major companies. Then we talk here 100,000 miles, and you have no longer a car, which actually for me looks like, I'm not saying it is, it looks like the planned obsolescence, so the people go for the new car, but right now they'll actually go for the electric one if they have enough of resources to buy it. So sitting in the hot oil isn't good for the bird life. I wonder what is the opinion of people who are professional in this area. Enter a cheer.
WS2S.
Go ahead, Paul. I was just going to comment that I don't think we have any automotive engineers in the audience tonight, but tell Wes what you wanted to say.
Okay.
No, I'm not an engineer for cars, but I was a driveway mechanic, you might call it, you know, my younger years, so spent a lot of time working with cars. But he mentioned Japan not switching over to that type of belt. They go with the chain. I can tell you the Hondas are still with the chain to the air. I have a CRV Honda. And the other ones, if you look in your book, it'll probably tell you, you know, 70 or 80,000 miles, the timing belt should be changed. You don't have to do that with my car. Other things might have to be changed, but I'm not going to worry about the timing belt because it is a chain. That's a good thing. That's my only comment. But, you know, you check your book, your manual, you know, when you get your car. And, you know, you're going to see all the different things that you have to do when you get to a certain mileage. And that's usually on it. Back to that.
Wes, I think you need to wrap this up.
Okay, thank you very much. That was all of it. If you want to give the comment about the belt or to Roy, because we don't have mechanics right now in here, and we wrap for today.
Okay, very good. We've talked about planned obsolescence. There's a big story about the light bulbs, I think back in the 1920s, and there's some old Edison bulbs that are still lit and working. They produce far less illumination, but they can have a very long lifespan. Anyway, also the World War II German rocket engineers, a lot of them went to the Russians as well. They had their version of Operation Paperclip as well. So we got Wernher von Braun and some very clever rocket engineers, and they got a bunch of similar German engineers. Anyway, I hope everyone learned something, or at least was entertained or amused. And I want to thank everyone that participated tonight. And it's certainly time for Paul WS2N and the SpaceNet Report.
Thank you very much.
Okay. And I use up some of the net time already for a space topic with Wes's YouTube about the Russian engines. And Karl of it was the he became the father of the Russian space agency, and we wound up with von Braun, which was pretty cool. You know. But Karl of it was not he was not German. He came out of the Ukraine. So there you go. I want to mention the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope that's, you know, being developed, and they just moved into another facility for testing. They've got a lot of work to do on it, but it's moving along. And that thing has a mirror similar to the Hubble, you know, almost 8 feet in diameter. And will be launched, you know, actually in a couple of years, 2027. But it will do a heck of a job once it gets up to its orbit. The orbit is going to be the L2 location, Lagrange Point 2, out where the James Webb Space Telescope is, a million miles away from Earth, roughly four times the distance of the moon. And you know, it's going to be a great telescope. You know, not different, definitely different than the James Webb Space Telescope. But similar in respect to the Hubble Space Telescope. Imagine taking a Hubble Space Telescope and putting it out at the L2 location instead of orbit, you know, 350-mile orbit around Earth, and just have a different mirror, you know, cut differently, where you're going to get 100 times the field of view than what the Hubble gets with the Nancy Grace telescope. But yet you're going to have the same, you know, the same focus. You're going to be able to see the same as what Hubble sees, except with a much bigger field. You know, to me, it's like putting 100 Hubble space telescopes into space. That's the way I look at it. Looking forward to that launch, and that won't take place until 2027. And we'll see how that goes. Any questions? Because I know it's getting late already, so I should take questions if anybody has them before we continue on. WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the text.
WB2BX.
Good evening, Frank. How are you?
Doing good. Two things. First of all, you mentioned the Russians getting their own, their own Panamunde engineers from Van Braun's group, and of course their version of the V-2 became the Scud missile, and a variant of the Scud, of course, is still being used in the Middle East and by Russia and Ukraine, I believe. So, unfortunately, their work has had a very long life also. And, yeah, I had forgotten. I just said Kirilliev was Ukrainian. I guess I hadn't really thought about that, but one of the first things the Russians made sure they did was destroy Rocket Factory Ukraine. But those people are still around, and I think they'll ultimately do a job on the Russians if they're given a chance to. I know they're working on it. And the other thing was, is your impression, maybe you're going to get into it, is your impression that Starship Flight 7 is going to be the first orbital flight? I think the last thing I saw was first orbital flight, no catch attempt. Go ahead.
Yeah, I heard that if the relight of their engines on the last flight was successful, and they said it was only 1 second relight, but I guess good enough as far as they're concerned, that number 7 would be an orbital flight. So I guess they're sticking to that. You must have read that. But yeah, before 6 went up, I heard that might be a possibility. So we'll see. You know, they got to do something. They're doing a lot, but they're still way behind schedule. You know, they thought they would have had passengers on this thing by now when they started years ago. You know, which was overly optimistic. I remember that one guy from Japan actually paid money. He thought he was going to go on an orbital trip around the moon, and he was going to bring half a dozen passengers with him. And that didn't work out. Well, it kind of worked. It didn't work out for the other passengers, but it worked out for him because he bailed out and he went with the Russians, and he actually did go up to the space station for a week on a Soyuz vehicle. You know, that fellow from Japan, some billionaire in the textile industry. So, okay, Frank. I agree. That's probably what's going to happen. And we'll have to see. The last one went up. There wasn't much of a difference between 5 and 6. 5, of course, they caught the booster, and they plan on doing the same thing with number 6. Apparently, you know, the information that they got back as it was going up was whatever it was they didn't like. I haven't found actually what was wrong, but they didn't like it, so they called it off when I say called it off, trying to catch the air, that booster, and they just brought it down into the Gulf of Mexico, and it tilted over, when it hit the water, and then the methane tank broke apart, and the thing blew up. So that was the end of number six. Back to you, Brian.
Yeah, I saw the replay for some reason. I'm not sure why I actually missed it live. It didn't come up on my phone for some reason. Anyway, yeah. I mean, they're way behind where Elon Musk wanted them to be in theory. You know, they talk about Elon time, that he wants impossible things. But they're still way ahead of where NASA or anybody else could be. And, of course, the Chinese are desperately trying to reverse engineer what he's doing to do their own, you know, which I kind of understand that because it still gives the United States a kind of unbeatable, even if it is way, way beyond where Musk wants to be. Of course, he bought himself the right to do whatever the heck he wants with no regulation, but that's a whole other issue. He's maybe not be where he wants to be, but he's far ahead of where anybody else could have been. Whether we like it or not, it will give the United States a pretty much unbeatable commercial and strategic lead. Anyway, we'll see what happens on Flight 7, which I think is supposed to be in March. And, of course, I don't think they're going to have any trouble getting a license to do it anymore. WB2BXL.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, they have a license for this one already. 6 and 7 were pretty much good to go. Once they got 6, they knew they were going to get 7. And, yeah, the company's really being run by that woman, Gwen Shotwell. And his 11,000 employees, you know. But, you know, he's the face of SpaceX. Now, they did succeed in getting their 400th Falcon 9 off the ground this week as well. And that was more of Starlink satellites. And I think it was 22 of them. And out of that group, there was 6 that are going to be dedicated to cell phone use. So, you know, the frequencies and the antennas and everything are all on these things. Are they going to really be used for somebody, you know, on a cell phone? I don't know. You know, I don't know about that. You know, it's ready for commercial use or not. I don't know, but there are 6 of them for that purpose. Like I said, a week or so ago, you know, I just can't see using my cell phone from, let's say, my basement and making it to the satellites. I think I'd have to be outside. I don't even know if it would work inside of a car, you know, with a metal top. We'll have to wait and see. Anyway, any other comments?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm hitting the wrong button on the phone. Yeah, I don't think the intent of the D2S D2C direct to cell, maybe S2C satellite to cell service, is to replace, at least not initially, to replace ground based cell service in urban areas where there are cell sites. It's to work in areas where there are no cell sites. Most of Africa, probably parts of the Middle East, parts of Asia, et cetera. And even some parts of the United States with cell service is very spotty, come to think of it. I mean, I still think there are some parts, you know, I know there are still some parts of the United States where you cannot get a reliable cell system, cell signal if you get it at all. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. You know, when I use my cell phone, you know, I don't pay attention to what carrier I'm going through on, you know. So you're saying if I'm in, you know, Borneo somewhere, and I break out my cell phone, and I could be transmitting, and it could be going up to one of Elon's satellites, and I don't know it, and then from there it's going into a gateway, and I'd be calling home. Is that what you think it is, Frank?
Yeah, I think that's the kind of application, and I'm sure they're going to try to charge you more for it. It's probably going to be some kind of roaming service, at least initially. So it won't be completely transparent to you. You know, if they're doing roaming, it's going to have to show a little symbol on your phone that says, hey, you're roaming, you're on the satellite, you're going to pay more for this. That's how I think it would work. And strictly speaking, technically, it's no longer cell service anymore because the cell concept, you're not really following the cell concept anymore, but you're using the same hardware and I guess similar software, WB2BX.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's going to be interesting. You know, because the Kuiper system is going to be like that. That's the one from Jeff Bezos' company. And that's supposed to be like that, where, you know, once those 3,000 satellites are in operation, they're all going to have cell capability. And the idea is we won't know when we're going through the satellite or not. But, yeah, okay, there's going to be a little symbol coming up on your phone. Back to Rome, the roaming days. When all those cell phones started coming out, I remember that. If you were, you know, you weren't on your local, you know, carrier, you know, you're roaming on a cell phone. Those cell phones had antennas, you know. I mean, we have antennas now. It's just that, you know, you don't see them. You had the little antenna. Some of them were telescopic. Yeah, maybe they'll go back with that, you know. You just can't hit the satellite. Maybe we'll have an external antenna on the next versions of all these cell phones that they make. Anyway, there was one other interesting launch that occurred last Friday, and that was a new Shepard vehicle, new Shepard 28, they called it. A suborbital flight by Blue Origin. And they put six more people into space. And that was pretty good. I did get a chance to see that. And the vehicle that they went up in has been used, I think 7 or 8 times, they said, you know, the booster, and they came back and landed successfully about 2 miles away from where it took off from. And the crew of six came back down, 3 parachutes, no problem. You know, they get up to around 2,800 miles an hour as they're going up. Up to 3,000, I think it's around 3,500 feet, not 350,000 feet, which is above the common line, above the 62-mile area. And then they have about 4 or 5 minutes of weightlessness, and they come back down. This is their 9th crewed flight on a new Shepard vehicle. And he plans on doing a lot more. He just completed another, Jeff Bezos, he's the one that's in charge of Blue Origin. They just completed and tested another vehicle about about 3 weeks ago. Brand new booster, brand new crew vehicle. But the they didn't put a crew in it. It was the inaugural flight of this new booster and crew vehicle. So now I'll have two, and they'll be able to increase their manifest over the next year or so. So a lot of people have been flying into space, not necessarily orbital, but suborbital as well. So they had this one on board, Emily, from Emily, the space girl or something. She does a lot of YouTubes, and she's got her own show. She's been interviewed on TV quite a bit. Very young, and she got to go up. She's very happy. She says she's the 100th woman to actually fly into space. And then they had another couple that went up. It was their second trip on this vehicle. So they did it before. They did it again. They're a married couple. And then three other people. So and that's pretty good. And we'll see. They're getting ready for their new Glenn launch. When I say they, Blue Origin. They have the infrastructure set up. You know, little by little, they've been, you know, getting to the point where they could launch. They tested out the second stage engines about a month ago. And the second stage engines consist of two BE-3 engines. Now, the BE-3 engine is the same one that they use on this new Shepard vehicle. When that thing goes up, it's going up with liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. Being used one, with one engine, I think it's around 130,000 pounds of thrust. Now, one engine that they use, they decide, well, let's take two of those engines, and we'll use that for the second stage of the New Glenn vehicle. And they tested both those engines, and now they're about ready to test the seven BE-4 engines, which will be the booster. Going to light them off at the pad, and you know, a couple of seconds, and then if everything's good, they'll set up for a launch probably in December. You know, we'll get to the end of November. They originally were going to launch in October. They canceled that. They had more to do, and then they wound up in November, and now it looks like December they will launch their first heavy lift vehicle. This is a big rocket. Each one of these engines produce more thrust than one of Elon Musk's engines. You know, I think it's around 560,000 pounds of thrust on each one. They have seven of them. These are the same engines that they also sell to NASA, to the United Launch Alliance. When the new Vulcan rocket launched, so far it's launched two times. It was launched with these BE-4 engines. The BE-4 engine, unlike the upper stage of the new Glenn rocket, which uses liquid hydrogen, the BE-4 engines use liquid methane and liquid oxygen. So, you know, when they launch these seven engines for the first stage, there's already some experience with the launch of these BE-4 engines, because ULA has launched two Vulcan rockets so far, and each rocket contains two of these monster engines. And they both flights were, you know, 100% as far as the engines are concerned. So it worked out. I mean, the second flight they had a little problem with Northrop Grumman's, one of their solid boosters gave them an issue, but they're not worried about that. That's nothing to do with these brand new engines. built by Blue Origin. So we'll see how it goes. We're looking forward to the New Glenn launch probably next month. Anyway, I'm looking at the time. Let me just see if anybody had any last comments before we turn back to Annette.
This is Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. I'll speak to you next week, Paul.
Sounds good, Charlie. Glad to hear from you, and we'll catch you next week. And very good. All right. With that, we'll turn it back to Roy, AT2GS, WS2N, for the Space Net report for the TechNet. We'll be here tomorrow night. ClubNet is always on at 8:30 on these repeaters. Try to check into that. Back to you, Roy.
This is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do here on the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it, and I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had a good time. I hope you'll join us again next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. Well, as usual, our rebels now are done. Just remember that Dick used to end most of his technical nets with the good advice, be kind to each other. That's always good advice. And don't forget good old Epictetus. It is impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So try and keep your mind open to new ideas, but don't open it wide enough that your brain might fall out, because you're going to need that someday. Anyway, have a great Thanksgiving. Don't eat too much. Don't eat too little. Stay safe. Be well. And please come back next Sunday at 8 p.m. when we do it all over again. And I will be clear after I say the usual Slava Ukraini.
GreatNet AC2LR clear.
AC2LR WS2N. Long time no hear. Good to hear from you.
Paul, I left you a link in this chat room for a really cool view from the, I think they pronounce it the cupola in the International Space Station.
Okay, yeah, let me look at that before I go. Very good. We'll check that out. Yeah, I think I probably signed off. I'll probably have to sign back in again. Will do. Thank you.